The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Okay, we got to go fast tonight. So if ever there was a reason to choose a book because of its author, tonight is the night. If ever there was a time we needed pure entertainment, it's now. So buckle up, it's going to be a great ride. Good evening, everyone. I'm Toby Gordon Dichter, daughter of Amelia Gordon, and a proud director of this library. I know you haven't read the book because it just came out today. Tim O'Brien is finally here again. Many of us know him from the times he's been at this wonderful place before, and because of the things they carried, his book, which won all the prizes and taught us up close about what it was like to be in Vietnam. True Pictures from True Life. America Fantastica is all fiction. It's all fantasy. Or is it? Is it perhaps just a sardonic distillation of what life and lies can do? I had a reader's copy and loved every laugh-out-loud moment. A guy who works at JCPenney's robs a bank. That alone tells you what America Fantastica. It was one of the fall's most anticipated books. Tim O'Brien was born William Timothy O'Brien on October 1st, 46. His mother was a teacher, his father sold insurance. He's the oldest of three children, and he loved to read. He lived in a tight-knit rural town, and after studying political science in St. Paul, he fought in Vietnam. When he returned to the States, he studied at Harvard and worked at the Washington Post. And his first book, If I Die in a Combat Zone, Box Me Up and Ship Me Home, was a compilation of his articles about the war. And as you may know, the war played prominently in many of his other books to follow. One of the two protagonists in Northern Lights is a wounded war hero. Going After Cacciato, which won the National Book Award, follows both a soldier who abandons his platoon in Vietnam to try to walk to Paris, and a fellow infantryman who escapes the war's horrors by inventing elaborate fantasies about their journey. In The Things They Carried, a fictional narrator named Tim O'Brien begins his memoir with a description of the items that members of the platoon took to war. Then came a nuanced comic novel, then July, July, whose disillusioned characters gather for a college class reunion. And in 2019, a loving book about his sons, which is the last time he was here. But this is his first novel since 2002. So perhaps Tim O'Brien is that infantryman who chose to escape the horrors of a country now divided through inventing elaborate fantasies. As he himself has said, fiction is the lie that helps us understand the truth. Come on out here, along with our marvelous, wonderful curator of these lectures, Andy Cahan. Come on out here, Tim O'Brien, and tell us the truth.
Hello, Tim.
Hello.
Good to see you again.
Great to see you. Great to be back in Philadelphia. Unfortunately, the Phillies are playing. I found that out 10 minutes ago. This happened to me at a college that was in the Elite Eight. Dayton, I don't know, 15, 18, 20 years ago. Four people came. Three of them with radios. So I'm used to it.
Well, if you see any phones glowing, they're just checking their stocks, not the games. I wouldn't sweat it. So did you want to read a little bit just to give us a flavor of the book to get us started?
Sure. I have to do a little backstory. It's on page 13, so it's not a lot. My main character is a guy named Boyd Halverson. He's got four names. That's the first name you'll learn from him. He has many identities. He's a compulsive liar. He reminds me of somebody in political office. He can't stop. He lies about everything, his age, his weight, his net worth, his mother, his father, what they did for livings. He lies about the schools he'd gone to, not USC, it was, UPenn. Everything. And he's lied not only to other people, but to his wife. He's a recently divorced guy, not recently, 10 years ago, who had been a very well-known journalist, but his lies were discovered. His resume was completely invented. Got fired. All this has happened before the book opens. He's a JCPenney store manager, and he spent 10 years with Rayon, and he's tired of it and can't take it selling another blouse or another nightie or a pair of socks. He's just fed up with it. He lives in a small town in Northern California that I invented, a town called Fulda. One day he's attending his Kiwanis brunch. Now I'm into the actual novel. And Kiwanis is like Rotary or the Elks Club, something, you know, organization like that. And it's noon on a Saturday or close to noon. He gets up, crosses the street, goes into the Community National Bank, shows the teller a small handgun that his ex-father-in-law had given him, and asks how much money is on hand. The teller, a diminutive redhead girl named Angie Bing, I say girl because she's in that age sort of between woman and girl, early 20s somewhere. And she says, "Are you robbing me?" And he says, "Not you." And then she proceeds to rob the bank. She rounds up the money, $81,000, and they hit the trail. The rest of the novel is a kind of road trip through contemporary America, the America we've all lived to, through. The book takes place in 2019 to 2020, 1 year. And you know what that year was filled with. It was the beginning of COVID in the early 2020s. I think January or February or March, somewhere in there it broke out. It was the year of impeachment. It was the year of lies coming across, you know, if you tuned into CNN or the Fox Channel. They end up in Mexico very briefly, just for a second. Boyd has taken the teller hostage. And he's already beginning to regret it. So in Santa Rosalia, they got off the bus and walked 4 blocks to a modest seaside hotel. As had been their practice since Saturday, Angie had first dibs on the toilet and shower. Then she slipped into bed, fully dressed. Afterward, Boyd took his turn. When they'd settled in, Angie said, "I'll need fresh clothes tomorrow. Underwear and jeans and shirts and socks and an electric toothbrush and a new nose stud and probably a camera and a good wristwatch." Boyd grunted and closed his eyes. Angie Bing exhausted him. "I'll need shoes too," she said, "casual ones, maybe sandals and a couple pairs of decent heels. I like those spiky ones. And if we'll be eating out all the time, you know, like in restaurants, I'll need dresses and skirts and stuff and a shawl for when it gets chilly at night and a manicure set and spending money." An unpleasant taste rose in Boyd's throat. "What about going home?" "How so?" "Home," he said. "Don't you want that?" "Of course I do," she said. "But until then, whenever then is, I'll need things. I'll need an ankle bracelet." She's a non-stop motor mouth. She talks and talks throughout it, and she's irrepressible, nothing stops her. And I fell in love with her 20 years ago when I first wrote maybe 18 or 20 pages of this book. Just, I had to put it aside, I became a dad, as Andy knows, and gave up writing for 20 years. I wanted to be a decent father, and I couldn't be spending 15 hours a day at a computer. And even when I'm not at the computer, I'm at the dinner table, thinking about Angie and Boyd and what's going to happen to them. For those 20-some years, Angie just yapped at me. She was constantly talking to me, and or so it seemed in my writerly imagination. She'd say things like, "I'm cute, I'm smart, I'm Pentecostal, I'm a missionary, I can save souls, I can even save your lying soul." Guy's a compulsive liar. And she believes it. She's out to rescue the world. She wouldn't stop talking to me. And so finally, when my kids were in one in senior in high school now, the other are junior in college now. When they'd grown up, I was able to finally go back to the typewriter and wrote this book. That's where the book was born.
So when was that, 2019?
When I began writing was 20, oh God, I'm so bad at years, probably 2017, somewhere in there, right after finishing Dad's Maybe book, when I returned to the book. But in the meantime, the world had delivered the rest of the story for me. What had happened in America with, the Capitol building and everything else, conspiracy theories coming out of talk radio at night, the most ludicrous stuff, which I tried to write a satire. It's a funny book, I hope, I think. In fact, it is. Just believe me.
And he's right. It's hilarious.
When I was in college, I'd read I guess you'd call it an essay called A Modest Proposal by Jonathan Swift, in which he was doing satire, saying the cure for famine in Ireland is to eat our children. Plenty of protein, it's fresh, it's not packaged meat, lots of vitamins, it'll solve the problem. He was making fun of what was of real proposals that were ludicrous to solve the problem of famine. It was so entertaining and so weird to read, eat your children to cure famine, and kind of had a nice nasty edge to it that appeals to my sense of humor. So that was one of the engendering things behind the tone of the book. If you can't beat them with rationality, let's laugh at them, the liars in public places. They're not going to like it any more than I like getting laughed at. Another influence was the latter Mark Twain. When he got older, he really went after this country for being overly pious and hypocritical. Hypocrisy really ticked off Mark Twain, Sam Clemens, as it does me. It seems to me one of the cardinal sins. You talk out of one side of your mouth. Part of it came from the, not politics really, but say you call up AT&T, or you call up an airline, or you call up a bank, and you get this recorded message saying, our phone lines are unusually busy. Enjoy the flute music for the next 40 minutes. They're not unusually busy. They're always busy. Always. It's a recording. You don't like listen in and to say when to run it. Well, it's a lie. It's a recorded lie that we've come to accept. We've learned to live with that kind of lie. And I find myself talking to the recording as it's going on, saying, you're not unusually busy, you're all the stuff I just said to you. Just yapping at it, the same way I often yap at my television set when I watch the news. I'm talking back at it, which strikes me as one form of insanity, I guess. It's driving me crazy. And that fed its way into the book, too. Is that stuff funny? Well, not when it's happening. No, it's only funny in retrospect.
So you set out to write a satire from the get-go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the idea was to write a serious book that's fun to read, that's entertaining, that preaching about anything is basically worthless. You're not going to convert anybody in the political spectrum. It's too diverse a country for that. It's a heterogeneous country. And laughter and entertainment can be shared. So the hope of a writer is that by writing a book that's fun to read, there's no message, really, except I guess I don't think lying is a great thing to do, but that's it.
Well, but you don't think it's a great thing to do, but it's how you make your living, right? Basically?
That's the irony. I guess that's hypocrisy. I'm a fiction writer. I'm a born storyteller and therefore a born liar. There is no Angie Bing. I made her up. It's a lie. No Boyd. No bank robbery. No ankle bracelets. But at least on my book, it says a work of fiction, that it's branded as that. So I admit it. I hope others do.
Because the book is also a crime caper, a lot of things happen, and there are a number of plots that run parallel to one another and sort of helically and Mobius-strippily affect one another. So I don't want to give away too much of the book, so I think we'll have to talk around it a bit. So we've met Angie Bing, and we know that she came to you early on. Give us some more background about Boyd, and I would say the other character that I see as the main character in the novel, there are three to my mind, or my reading of it, is the mythomania that crops up every X number of chapters. Mm-hmm. This sort of contagion that's sweeping the land that goes back to ancient times,
right,
and somehow conflates, the lies end up conflating with the viral contagion that ends up rocking
sort of
the end
COVID
of the book.
COVID and mythomania, the lying disease, commingle in the book. I did not make that word up. Mythomania is a psychological term. Another word for it is pseudologia fantastica. That's where my title came from. It's a psychiatric or psychologist's fancy word for compulsive lying. Basically, what it means is that for some people, the disappointed, the despairing, those who've had their wives leave them and they're fired and the world has collapsed, that reality becomes a kind of monster. And to deal with it, fantasy replaces reality. Elaborate fantasy, which is a form of lying, of course. And it's an interesting concept because we all need fantasies to get through life, that tomorrow will be better than today. We hope for it. Or that, well, for some people, they buy lottery tickets with the fantasy of winning, even though the odds are astronomical, especially when it gets to like Powerball at the time. And casinos all across this country are flourishing. Fantasies full in our movies. I grew up back in the 50s, came of age. And the fantasies were sort of romantic fantasies, not exactly Ozzie and Harriet, more like Pat Boone falls in love and April Love and sings, songs to his beloved and everything ends happily. The happy ever after fantasy, I call it. We all hope for it, but we also know what awaits us eventually. It's death. And we find all kinds of fantasies to try to avoid thinking about the inevitable. We play softball and cricket and bridge and go through our lives, root for the Phillies, as if it matters. Yeah, they win, lose. Somebody's going to win, somebody's going to lose. And, next year, not most of America, except people in Philadelphia, are going to forget that the Phillies won. They're going to say, who won last year?
They're not going to forget, Tim. They are not going to forget.
Everybody's checking their phones right now to see what the score is. So fantasies they're necessary. They keep us going. The daydream of, maybe I'll meet somebody when I go to that bar tonight that you have when you're 23 years old. And most often it doesn't pan out. Now it then pans out badly. It's a fantasy that keeps us going through life. There are millions of kinds of these. It's the ones that hurt other people that I'm writing about, the ones that are destructive, that destroy your own soul. You're lying about things that are important that you should not be lying about, and that hurt other people. Those are what I go after with some humor in this book, the ones that are painful to other people and to make fun of them.
Well, and lies also in the book can be salubrious. They can be helpful, useful to characters as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, without lies, we have no Boyd Halverson. Angie's unable to help him unless she's living according to the fantasies that she has. But she also, at one point, I think, she tries to save him by lying to him. Mm-hmm. And it seems to work and it seems over the course of the book to be useful.
But then he
calls her on it also. He figures it out.
Yeah, there's a kind of a moral tug of war going on between Angie. She's trying to save him, but when the obvious ways don't work, she resorts to deceit herself as a way of trying to help him. The way, say, some charlatan cult leader might try to help you with, you know, deceit about, you know, we're going to be attacked by Martians. I can't remember this exact story. It's real, but some kind of interplanetary thing is going to land and pick us all up and take us off to some other planet. Do you guys know what the cult I'm talking about? A bunch of people died.
Like 60-some-odd people died.
And
what was it?
Heaven's Gate.
Heaven's Gate. Yep. Yeah, Heaven's Gate.
That's it.
The Nike sneakers everybody was wearing. Are you wearing Nike sneakers? You are. Yeah.
That was actually true. That happened to my wife.
What do you mean?
No, I'm kidding.
Oh. I'm going to believe anything you say, so I'm a sitting duck right now, unless you say the Phils are going to lose. And speaking of Phillies, why don't I detour? So you have one of your characters, and we'll come back, but Junius is, he's I would call him a secondary but motivating character in the novel, and pitches against the Phillies. He creates a team, and the Phillies seem to be the team that he is dead set on beating. How did that happen? Why the Phils? Is it a gift to me?
It's a childhood fantasy of my own that someday, one on nine, I would play the Yankees or the Brooklyn Dodgers back then and beat them single-handedly. My character Junius is a 65-year-old billionaire who owns his own major league team that just lost 500 games in a row. And he's so pissed off at his team that he benches them all and he goes out to the mound and he's the sole player. So he's both pitcher and catcher. So you can imagine how long this game lasts. After every pitch, and he can't throw a straight ball. He has to hump back to the backstop, get the ball, go back to the mound, throw another. Game goes on for eternity. All the fans desert the stadium. He's defeated, like 70-0 or something like that. The Phillies just clobber him. So you can take heart in that in case they lose tonight.
I wish we were playing.
They managed to beat one old man.
Well, to circle back to mythomania, and this is sort of, Boyd is both a fount of mythomania and mythomania itself, as well as there are these interstitial chapters about mythomania. But at the root of it for Boyd and some of the other characters as well, there's this deep-seated shame that they're hiding. And I wonder if you could talk about that a bit, because it seems motivating.
Boyd himself is a bearer of great shame. He grew up on the slow side of some really fast tracks out in L.A. and Santa Monica, where he was childhood. He was a paper boy to the movie stars when he was young. He delivered Rosemary Clooney's paper. And only people who are my age are going to know who that is. George Clooney's aunt, I think. That might ring a bell. She was a famous singer. She sang with Bing Crosby in movies, and she had a TV. She was on the Hit Parade, all the 10 top hits were sung on television. He delivered newspapers to all these superstars, and he was surrounded by celebrity. And he lived in the wrong side of those tracks in southeast Santa Monica, where little bungalows back in the 1940 would be bought for $30,000, now worth $3 million or so. And his father sells used cars, and his mother is way, way, way overweight, 600, 700 pounds by the end of the book. And he's deeply ashamed of his father having a used car salesman job and his mother being so grossly overweight. And he's so ashamed that as a boy, when he comes home from school, he takes a deep breath when he opens the front door and runs for his bedroom and then expels the breath when he gets there so he doesn't have to speak to anyone. He claims the house smells fat, like Wesson oil, that the odor of it. And so he's grown up with a psychiatrist would say, an inferiority complex. That sounds so stupid and simplistic. But those who grow up the have-nots of this world, and by have-not, I don't mean just wealth. I mean have-not love, have-not parents that you take care of you and adore you and you adore back. When you're wanting, there's a shame that can accompany it, and boy, does he have it. Angie has a different kind of background. She grew up in a Pentecostal sort of Northern California family. in a congregation run by your father, a congregation of four. Angie is one of the members of the congregation, her sister's another member, and her mother's the other, and her father preaches every Sunday. And that's it. They live in a trailer park, and her father on the side grows mushrooms and makes plenty of money selling them. Not the Campbell's soup kind, the other kind. And it's a rugged, mother threw a stapler at her for taking the Lord's name in vain, and it was a tough background she went through. And these two characters, with their carrying this baggage from the past, collide, and you kind of heard the collision. It's not a sad one exactly. In fact, I think it's kind of a happy one that likened people come together. They're attracted. They both are carrying a lot of childhood baggage. Most novels treat that with pity, and I like to treat it instead with humor. It's another way of looking at the world. And they treat it with humor, the characters themselves.
Yeah, they both do, and it works. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about Randy. I don't think you've even mentioned him yet, actually. We were talking about him backstage, because he's a character that I love. But he's sort of despicable in a lot of ways.
Yeah. This is a big cast of characters. We're not going to do them all, we promise. But Randy is Angie's fiancé, one of several. Boyd later becomes one. They haven't actually become engaged. Angie just pronounces them, "You're my fiancé," and lays the law down, and they argue with her, but they get nowhere. He's a rodeo cowboy, part-time, and almost a full-time burglar, con man, lanky, a total doofus. But so doofusy that he's utterly self-confident about himself. He's just totally confident that he is so cool and so clever and so dangerous that his goal in life is to become Charles Manson. That's his fantasy. He wants to go to Corcoran State Prison as a convicted murderer. And he actually wants to be executed, but California doesn't execute people anymore, so that's, Martin Manson wasn't even executed. It's his dream, it's his great fantasy, and he tells stories about all the stuff he knows about Charles Manson. The way he'd eat spaghetti, he'd take one noodle or spaghetti strand, and he'd twirl it around his finger, and he'd dip it in the sauce, and then lick it off. And he thinks that's cool, and things like that are cool, but that's his goal in life. He is dangerous. He kills people in the book. A guy that I loved being as I wrote him, I loved being a dumbball. It was so fun to say the stuff. He was proud, for example, of the way he drove his Cutlass. He was a thumb driver. He would drive with one thumb on the wheel. And he thought that was such a cool thing. And to have a character who is underestimated by everybody except himself, he thinks he's great. So he was fun to write.
Yeah, he's a pretty wily guy. And funny, as despicable as he is. How did you make him funny? Because on a sentence level, it's just the writing is so fleet and the juxtapositions work. Being dumb isn't necessarily funny. A lot of it comes from the context.
It has to be in the thought. You've got to be the person. The person who's a doofus doesn't think he's a doofus. He thinks the opposite. I'm cool. And that's how I felt when I was writing Randy. The thing about doing novels or fiction of any sort, I think, is that one sentence opens the door to the next one. It's not planned out in advance. I don't think of dialogue or ideas, stuff to put in Randy's mouth or in his head. It grows out of the sentence, and something will happen in a sentence that'll lead to the next one, it'll lead to the dialogue. And it's paying attention to the flow of the sentences the same way that we really do in life. Like when you walked into this room, I don't think you planned what you were going to do or how you were going to react. You're reacting in your heads to what's going on up here, and maybe even what's being whispered to you by the person beside you. But it's happening second by second by second by second. And to me, outlining or planning a novel or a story or a whole, or a, and any sort of book probably, except not I'm discounting nonfiction, but any sort of fiction, planning is a kind of death sentence because it robs the writer of his own discovery as you're going through it. So when characters say things that surprise me, that elates me. It keeps me going to want the same way it would as a reader. If I'm surprised and I laugh or smile or shed a tear, it keeps me going to the next sentence.
We don't have much time left for me to ask you questions, but I wanted to circle back to a question that I was going to ask you to start the conversation. And I think I'm wrong about this, but I'm not sure. You said you started thinking about the book and writing it about 20-some-odd years ago,
right,
or more than that, and Angie came into your head. Mm-hmm. I imagined that the book came, and I got this sense reading it, from a potentially a place of fear for the world that your children were walking into. Mm-hmm. Any correlation there? It just seemed like you were writing about this disaster that's slowly unfolding with great humor.
Yeah.
But I was reading it as coming from potentially a place of fear, but maybe that's just reader response theory and I'm grafting my own concerns onto it for my kids.
Yeah, I mean, I think any father fears for his children coming into any world. There is so much bad stuff that can happen to a child. And to all of us. I'm also full of hope that lying and the problems like destroying democracy as a consequence of a lie, that's a big problem. And I worry about it. Undermining a constitutional democracy with lies is not good. That's what I meant about hurting people. But I'm confident that Americans as a whole are smart enough and kind enough and generous enough, wise enough not to swallow it and not to let it happen. So I do feel confident. There has been a warning sounded, almost a cataclysmic warning, that like the Civil War, like World War II, like Vietnam, that I went through personally, the last few years have been a kind of a watershed. Let's shut down the government completely, like do away with it. That's new and frightening for those who depend on government, that is to protect us, for some people to get food and water and electricity and power and have your toilets work and all the stuff that, you know, the governments do that we sort of take for granted, our highways, paving them and so on. And to have it threatened and go into chaos is frightening. It is a kind of watershed. So my children grew up they didn't go to school for a year and a half because of COVID. So we got one sort of current flowing into the COVID scare. And that was revolutionary for all of us in some ways. Even if we didn't wear masks, we thought we should, and maybe even wished we were. We stayed home, businesses shut down, closed. The world changed for a year. I personally, because I nearly died of pneumonia a few years ago, I didn't leave the house for a year at all. I'd go out in the backyard, but I mean my property, but I did not leave the property. It was revolutionary for me. I felt, fortunately, I was writing a book. That helped a lot. Made me sit down and keep typing. But it hurt because I'm a sociable kind of person, like I think most of us are. And so these currents collide, and you think of your children. And I am not without hope. I mean, I hope that's clear. I wouldn't have written a funny book if I had no hope. I would have written an embittered book, but I'm not that kind of person.
Well, that comes through. Good. I was just checking.
Okay.
let's see, how are we for time? I think we can move on to questions from the audience. So if you have a question, please raise your hand and we'll get to as many of you as we can before the seventh inning stretch.
It's wonderful to hear your sense of humor and investment in the world. How did you decide, having written serious and emotional books about what I take it is your personal experience in Vietnam, how did you decide that you could address this world in humor and not give in to it?
Right. A couple of kind of responses to that. My subject has always been America. Even the Vietnam books, I'm writing about American soldiers at war and another war in Vietnam, but I'm not writing from the viewpoints of the Vietnamese. In the Lake of the Woods is a story of a man who's been deceitful as well. And it's a story of, it's an American story. And obviously this one is too. This book goes from California to Mexico to southern Texas to Kansas to Oklahoma to Minnesota to South Dakota down to spend a lot of time in Deadwood in this novel, over to Las Vegas, up to Seattle. It's a journey through the America of 2019, 2020, with talk radio coming out of the radio as they're driving around with their $81,000. It's slowly dwindling. So that's one answer. I feel like I haven't changed a lot. What changed really was the tone. That I said earlier, and I don't know if you agree or not, but it feels to me that rational argument is useless these days. It feels as if two sides can't communicate and that argumentation doesn't do anything. There's a line from Socrates that the object of our discussion is not that your words should triumph over mine or mine over yours, but that between us, we might discover the most perfect truth. I learned that quote way back in high school, a long time ago. And that was the world I had believed in, that through discussion and rational argumentation, we would arrive at some accommodation of rough sense of what the truth of things is. We should try to do this. And it seems now less and less promising and likely. What do we have left? We have left what a novelist, an essay writer can do, which is to poke fun at the preposterous situation in which we find ourselves in, with the hope that through sort of laughing at something, we might chill a little bit and maybe start talking. If we can laugh, we can talk. But if the sour faces I see on the Fox Channel and CNN every night, and I'm sure on right now, the sourness doesn't allow kind of human communication. So I believe in humor as a way of unsouring us, of helping us take ourselves and our ideals and ideas just a little, with a little grain of salt, that maybe we might be mistaken, maybe we can compromise, maybe we can get along without deceit.
Hi, longtime fan since Cacciato. So, do you think you would have written this book or written it very differently if the zaniness of the Trump administration had not existed?
Slightly. I mean, not totally. What first alerted me was talk radio and conspiracy. There was no Sandy Hook. That didn't happen, that sort of declaration. We didn't land on the moon. That never happened. Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill Kennedy. It was a conspiracy. And the people who say that, you know, come up with all kind of candidates for it. Reptiles man the phone banks at the IRS. That's like salamanders, to be precise. Literal. They don't mean like salamanders. And what they forget with that one is the IRS doesn't answer its phones either. So the reptiles are asleep. So all that is still with us in all kinds of ways. All you have to do is go on one of these internet chat rooms. My wife got me to look at them. I had heard about them, but never really, and was astonished. So in this book, I make up my own preposterous. For example, 16 of our presidents never existed. Rutherford B. Hayes, nobody. He didn't exist. He was just a B actor playing the part. Benjamin Harrison, same thing. Millard Fillmore, none of them existed. And this is spouted by what I call a truth seed. There are 8 of them across the country that spout these lies and call themselves truth seeds. About a honeymooning couple that spent their honeymoon aboard a sunken Soviet-era submarine off Block Island, enjoying the caviar and the skeletal crew taking care of them, and then emerged from the submarine to tell the press that they had been, you know, spent their honeymoon on a sunken sub. It was hard to beat reality with my lies. I had to stretch for it. Because the real ones, like Salamander, is manning the phone banks. I wish I'd come up with that one.
My favorite one in the long list was corporations are people.
My favorite one is guns are people.
Oh, yeah. America dances to the sound of gunfire.
That one I did make up.
Yeah, there are other good ones, too.
I mean, the Supreme Court ordered, that's corporations are people. But they have yet to declare guns people, that they may next week, so watch out. Make sure you're polite to your gun when it's pointed at you. It's a human being, don't get mad at it.
Hi, we have a group of high school English teachers here, and I did just want to say thank you for giving us a book in the things they carried that is such a pleasure to teach. We teach seniors, so having a book that can engage them has been really meaningful and special. You talked earlier about a quote that stuck with you since you were in high school, and I think you mentioned you have a son who's recently a high school senior. You mentioned that you have hope still. I was wondering what about this generation, the young generation, gives you hope, and is there any message that you would like them to hear?
I can only speak from personal experience, my own 2 sons. This gave me hope. My youngest son is a senior in high school now, who had never played football in his life, not in middle school, not in grade school. But in his senior year, took the risk of going out for football on a dare from a friend of his. He said, okay, I'll do it. And he knew nothing about football. He didn't know the rules of football. He didn't watch football. He loved basketball, but didn't care about football. So he made the team, and not only made the team, became a starter. And not only became a starter, became a starting right tackle on both offense and defense. This is a kid who succeeded by risking failure. He assumed he was going to fail. He thought he would fail. I'm a dwarf next to this kid. He's like 6'2 or so, and he's not at all fat or even chunky. He's slim, but really strong. And I'm so proud of him for risking. And I'm not sure that I would have had his nerve back then to do something that I'd never done before, fearing failure and failing in front of your friends on top of it, which is doubles the hurt of failure. He's afraid his friends are going to mock him and say, you couldn't do it. So the fact that young people are willing to risk new stuff, where I'm sort of solidified now in my habits and in my way I comport myself in the world. This is my idea of a risk. What Andy and I are doing right now, it's really scary. Talking about a book that you've worked on for, in a way, 20 years, in another way, 4 or 5 years, and then going before an audience and paraphrasing it, and never feeling you're doing justice to what you work so hard to do, which are the sentences that make the book. Instead, paraphrasing and simplifying, this is the closest I can come to a risk. But it's not quite as risky as what my own kid did.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for doing this. You had said that one of your characters, Angie, had been kind of floating around in your head for several years. I was curious, where do your characters come from? Who or what inspires them?
I don't know. They come from my waking dreams, sort of daydreams. I'm doing dishes, and it's 2 a.m, and I've just gotten out of bed, and these little bumblebees go through my head, mostly of memory. I'll remember something from Vietnam, just a little, nothing traumatic or scary, just an image will come to me. And then another bumblebee of a high school English teacher will zip through my head. The way Miss Wick would, she taught literature with her breasts. She was like 65 years old. And she would go like this as she was reading Wordsworth. And we were, everybody, including the women, tried not to laugh, but it was, and it bounced to the meter of Wordsworth. And that memory will come back to me, as it just did. So that's my little bumblebees of memory. They move into a kind of imaginative world. Like, what if I were to put Miss Wick in a book? But you can't make fun of her. You can't exaggerate. You have to be really cautious in doing it. But it's a challenge. Angie came to me in kind of the same way. That it was early morning, and this is 20 years ago, so I can't remember the circumstances very well, but she popped out of nowhere. This diminutive, 4 foot, 2 inch grown woman who was before me suddenly started talking. It probably came from somebody I'd seen 30 years ago, 25 years ago, or somebody I'd met. But I can't say that for sure. It felt as if she'd popped out of nowhere. The same with the rest of the characters, that I don't really model characters on people. They model themselves in my head somehow. They make themselves. And it's a mystery. A lot of writers I know of fiction talk about this, that it's a mystery to them too. There are those, usually mediocre writers, who do model characters on real people, but not always. Sometimes they're really good writers, like Hemingway modeled the characters in A Sun Also Rises after real human beings. Went to Pamplona together and to the bullfights. And there's a wonderful book written recently called Everybody Behaves Badly, a nonfiction book about this group of real people on whom Hemingway had, relied to create his characters. But for me, it comes through some magical thing that happens in my head. The way daydreams come to us, I think it happens to all of us in some ways or another, that your head goes somewhere and you're not quite sure why it went there and why you returned from where you went. It's a kind of mystery. I wonder often if the chipmunks have that, or the cows, or the squirrels. Do their heads go elsewhere, or do they just stay stuck on acorns their whole lives? And I've never asked one, and I doubt it they give a very good answer.
Well, apart from the squirrels, I was thinking that in some of your earlier works, the things they carried that the teacher mentioned, mm-hmm. I mean, some of them are based on some agglomeration of characteristics of a person you actually knew, even though you're resituating it and fictionalizing the tale.
Yeah, that book was a little different because I cast myself as the main character, make-believe me, but he carried my name and shared some of my characteristics where I grew up and so on. So in that book, yeah, I did, and I think 3 instances based characters in that book on real human beings.
I had a friend in Vietnam named Chip Merricks, a black kid from Orlando, Florida, who stepped on a landmine and was blown into a tree dead in all kinds of pieces. And Kurt Lemon is based on Chip. But the rest is imagined because it's the narrator, me, saying to myself in Vietnam that it was the sunlight that had killed him, because he steps from the shade into sunlight, hits the mine, and up he goes into the tree. And so maybe for that dying Chip Merricks, it might have felt that the sunlight did it, and up you go into the tree. It's a way of being curious about the last thoughts of human beings, what they must be and how peculiar they must be based on the instantaneous nature of some deaths. There's a wonderful book, called Exit Lines, and I can't remember the author anymore. I read it several years ago, but it's a compilation of last words that are really funny by dying people. It's sort of macabre, I guess, but they're real last words, like Victor Hugo's, and just a whole amalgam of them. A pretty wonderful book. That sort of thing about lastness, it just intrigues me.
Yeah, my favorite last line is Lawrence Stern, who wrote Tristram Shandy, and he throws his arm over his forehead, and he said, "It comes," and then he was gone. Is that in there?
Probably one in that book.
Speck, also, Henry Speck, you give him a fantasia at the end of his life from Fantastica. Do you recall that? Henry Speck, when he dies in Fantastica?
Oh, yeah, he's...
He's a secondary character.
He's another character. Not even really secondary. They're all like really great people.
Yeah.
He unfortunately is sort of a George Hamilton lounge lizard killer. But I love him anyway. Yeah, he sleeps with everything he can find as long as it's female. And probably doesn't even have to be human. And he dies finally of picking up COVID through one of his... assignations, and he dies on a ventilator in a hospital, dreaming that he's Secretariat, sort of romping through a pasture, which kind of suits his personality. Yeah, that's his last thought, and it's for him. It's an ecstatic, lovely thought. He loves being without a brain, or a brain the size of a horse.
Well, it's an ecstatic, lovely book. Everybody, please join me in thanking
Tim
O'Brien.
Thank you. Go Phillies! Thank you all for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.